Why is life better with American Family Insurance? Because every policy comes with something very special. A trusted agent who's there to help protect your dreams by finding the right coverage at the right price. Save up to 23% when you bundle home and auto. American Family Insurance. Get a quote and find an agent at AmFam.com.
Products not available in every state. Visit AmFam.com to learn how discounts may apply to you. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Welcome to The Deconstructionist. I'm your podcast host. I am John Williamson, and we are getting down to the end of the season. So this is part two of my interview with Sarah Stancorp. She's the author of the book Disobedient Women. It's a culmination of years of reporting on women who use the internet to call out abuse within their evangelical communities. For a lot of people who just didn't have a voice before. And so extremely important book and extremely important research and project that went into this. So really had a great conversation with her about it. You can see Sarah's articles and essays that have appeared all over the place, including the Washington Post magazine, the New York Times, Washington Post, Vogue, Mary Claire, Glamour, O Magazine, Slate, The Guardian, The Atlantic, just tons. She's very quite the prolific writer. And a wonderful interview. So hopefully you guys enjoy this. Again, as I mentioned in the first part, Sarah wanted to point out that she does deal with a vocal disorder. So at times it can make it kind of a little trickier to hear what she has to say. So I tried to give her a couple assists there. So we tried to amp up the volume a little bit so that hopefully you can hear it a little bit better. But might just have to concentrate a little harder. And also working on trying to get the transcripts up on the website. So if you want to follow along in written form, then you can do so as well. And in general, we've been working on trying to get transcripts put together as that's something that people have asked for years. And we just didn't have the technology then, but we do now. So we'll hopefully have that up there as well. Beyond that, go to our website, www.thedeconstructionists.com with an S on the end there. And so if you go there, you can find links to our social media. You can find links to our brand new web store with all sorts of new designs and options and international shipping now. So if you're listening from somewhere outside of the U.S., guess what? You can order stuff now. So if you want to support us that way, that's on there. Links to our Patreon, links to our blog, and also you can stream for free every single prior episode of this podcast, over 170 episodes for free directly from the website. You just have to hit play. So if you're a technology challenge like my father, then this is for you. So you can check that out. But otherwise, we'll be back with, I believe, one more episode. So got one more in the can, one or two, depends. I have to look and see how long the episode is. So least one more episode, and then take a short break as I work on another project for this podcast, and then hopefully we'll have more news very, very soon for you on that. So thank you so much for listening. Appreciate all the support from all the listeners out there. You keep me energized and keep me going. So happy 2024, and without further ado, I give you Sarah freaking Stancorp.
To my surprise, I can't accept that it was all just a lie. Do you even hope? 'Cause I am hopeless.
Yeah, as a parent, we call that the illusion of choice. You know?
Yes, yes.
Yeah, it's like we make you think you have a choice, but really they're all pre-approved options. So.
Yes, when I learned with my first kid, instead of saying, do you want to wear a shirt, which was always a no, do you want to wear the blue shirt or the green shirt? Oh, well, now there you go. I have limited your options. You feel like you have exerted your will. And now we can move on to maybe wearing pants.
Moves things along a lot quicker, doesn't it?
Yes.
It's very, very true. One of the interesting things is you talk a lot about there are, it's not just these stories. It's so like the layers are so complex, like in the sense that it's not just like a leader. It's not just like a pastor who's exerting kind of their influence, but like there are magazines, you know, there's, like I said, a lot of multiple layers. And you talk about something called the Patriarch magazine. And I'm like, what? They have a magazine? That's insane. But like this notion that where they are communicating this message that women are to make babies because they are arrows to help God in this fight, this holy war, to take over America. And that there's a quote in there where you say that they believe that in 40 years, 90% of America will be Christian. And I thought, how's that going?
Yeah, so that's Mary Pride, which it's been interesting. I've been kind of just snapshotting little quotes from the book and posting on Instagram and TikTok. That's a different story. But just these ideas from Mary Pride, I'm hearing from people who grew up in quiverful families, and they remember their mothers reading these books from Mary Pride, because she was so highly regarded, especially within Christian homeschooling families. She made the catalog back before the internet. She made the catalog where you could find a homeschool curricula. You could join associations that would advocate for homeschool families. She was the resource. So then she would also write these books, giving reproductive advice. And she would tell you how to raise your children. And she had these wild suppositions about how we as Christian mothers can increase the birth rate of Christians. Never any question that they may deconvert, but that through your womb, we can essentially take control of this country. And that's, you know, that's the sort of thing we're now hearing from extremist communities, and reading that from decades back, there were moments like that figure that were very chilling, because it's definitely still here. And it starts with a trusted resource. And I think it was also important for me to include figures like Mary Pride, because, sure, this is a system where men have a lot of authority, and holding on to that authority can result in abuse, it can result in cover-ups, they can maintain that authority, but you also have women who are in service of these systems and who help keep the other women in line and interested in being there and feeling like they're contributing. And it's not the patriarchy that's only maintained by men. It's the women definitely have a part too.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And you talk about some techniques that they use to keep women in this submissive role. And you talk about this horrific story about Ashley. You talk about with her childhood and growing up with her grandfather, who, you know, some perceived slight or misbehavior, he like locks her in a basement bedroom and like keeps her there for hours and hours until I think the term is like will breaking or something like that. And this was a technique that was commonly employed to keep women in this sort of submissive role.
Yeah, and just children. I mean, the wall breaking was children in general. And it's interesting that from his perspective, from what Ashley told me, it's a story that has come up over time. Like, it's one of those family stories you repeat when everyone's together. So it was like understood as a good thing that this had happened. Like, it, you know, she was just, she had been so wild and, you know, spirited. Look what I've done, look how I helped. And this is, you know, a formative, traumatic memory for her. It's just skip past. It's invisible to the experience of being the person made submissive. You don't have, often you don't have the voice to say, like, all of this hurts, all of this, because you're part of being submissive is not speaking up.
Yeah, and it's unbelievable. As someone who's a huge proponent of therapy, I couldn't help but wonder, I'm like reading these stories that these women are brave enough to tell that are absolutely horrific. And in some cases, like straight up child abuse. And I think to myself, like, gosh, like how many years of therapy must these poor women be in who have suffered these things that will probably stick with them the rest of their lives? Like, that is no small amount of trauma. That is absolutely horrific.
Yeah. So, I mean, so Krista Brown, who some people may know, she was one of the leading advocates calling for some sort of recognition to the abuse crisis within the Southern Baptist Convention. But when she first stepped forward in her 50s, which is actually 52, is the common age for people to finally speak up and recognize child sexual abuse. It's something people just carry anyway. But for Krista, when she first stepped forward, she had learned that SBC would pay for therapy to restore an abusive pastor. So all she was really asking for was enough money to pay for therapy at the same amount of time as they would give to an abusive pastor. And she also wanted a meditation garden, just having some small recognition. And absolutely not. That became too much to ask. And in some ways, if not for that initial battle, what it turned into, and what she learned from it, which was that her local state convention kept the list of credibly abused pastors, and they wouldn't make it public. When Krista learned that, she wrote a letter to the editor, and from that point on, that's when people started pouring into her, saying, this happened to me, this happened to me, this happened to me. And that's why she ended up documenting. It got up to 172 cases just based on public record. And then she finally needed to take a break. But all of that stemmed from, really, she just needed some help. She just needed some help. And there are moments when you hear a story like that when I wonder, you know, if they'd just given her therapy, she wouldn't have been in this position to learn all that she did. Where would SBC be now if they had just made that small concession? And maybe we wouldn't know the scope. So it's this mixed result where, because they were so horrible to Krista Brown, and because this became the fight of her life, eventually, at least the Houston Chronicle expose and story after story and guidepost solutions in the external investigation. And now we're starting to see how vast the scope of abuse is within SBC.
Yeah, and that seems to be like sort of a common thread. We could spend an entire extra hour on Bill Gothard in that part of the book, but that's just, I mean, he's just a statistic at this point. You know, like he is just another example of what we see in many, many other cases where there is a person in a position of power who is out of one side of his mouth preaching, you know, like so often, like it's like ironic and obviously very hypocritical. Like they're almost obsessed about the sex lives of women and abstaining and being pure and all these things. And then behind the scenes, they're absolutely completely taking advantage of their power position to, at the very least, sexually harass women under their leadership. And then in the end, you know, when it becomes public, and in this case, like you said earlier, through God, you know, thank God there was the internet at this point, through, in this case, a website, victims were able to come forward and say, hey, like, no, this happened to me also. But then in the end, the board, I think it was the board, right, of the of his organization, comes forward and doesn't even initially accept his resignation. They're like, well, let's wait to see how this plays out, you know, and then eventually they accept his resignation. But even then, they don't really, there really isn't the sense of like justice that you would expect. They're like, well, you can kind of stay on unofficially, but like you can't really pastor. And then even earlier than that, they clearly knew something was going on because behind the scenes they're like, maybe you shouldn't have female assistants. Maybe that's not a good idea. Like you clearly know what's going on, you know?
Well, and even so, one of the women who stepped forward in the book who hadn't been public before, she's there under pseudonym, but she was his personal secretary who he plucked out of one of the training centers. And she was 14. Oh. I mean, if you are on the board of an organization with a man who had a 14-year-old personal secretary, from what she tells me without much secretarial skill, who he stays late in the office with, who he sometimes would visit in her room at night when she was in her nightgown, either you're completely absent or you're looking the other way. There's just no other formulation in my mind that is logical. That case, and a lot of these are very dissatisfying. You don't end with, and then it went to jail. Instead, you have Gothard, who still has kind of quasi-ministries-ish, like on a website, his Facebook page. But you also still have people who insist he did nothing wrong, despite the legions who have come out to state, yes, he got me alone, he made me pray, he touched me inappropriately, he took his shoes off, he ran his feet all over my legs. It's just the consistency in these stories is staggering. And with what, wait, you said something that made me think of this. Gothard, when he was at his height, wrote books, he gave lectures, he hosted conferences. He created a lot of rules for people to live by. He would not approve of my listening to heavy metal, for sure. But he also would give guidance on every bit of your attire. And so here's how a woman should look. Here's how she should have her hair. Here's how makeup should be. If you have it, you should look natural. Here's how you should not draw attention to your chest with your clothing. On and on and on. What struck me is very interesting because it's consistently in my reporting, there are these young women who are teenagers when he found them and invited him to come work for him. There was a type, and it was known, it was something people talked about. Jill Duggar in her book references like the Gothard girls. And it was as if this, if you can imagine someone with a predatory nature who had the ability to get people to conform to their own taste, that's a level of grooming that is astounding. And then to be able to point people out and have young people, children, teens, and have their parents trust you to have them come live at your headquarters and see it as a gift from God. That's hearing that sort of story over and over, that can be pretty chilling.
Yeah, I can't imagine having to gather up all these stories and read, you know, case after case after case after case where you're seeing the same thing, and like, and yet nothing's done. I would, you know, say like, if this person had been in any other job, if they were, you know, a actor or a teacher or a comedian or whatever, they would have been canceled and put in jail years ago. But for some odd reason, we turned a blind eye because, oh, they've got the ear of the Lord. I'm like, well, they're also human.
Yeah, or human resources. I mean, yeah, it's really difficult. And then, I mean, then there's also, like, which I couldn't even get into, but the financial exploitation of calling these things internships, where, because people are too young to be working legally, you know, hand them $50 here or there, but they're working more than full time for you.
Yeah, I didn't even think about that. I do remember where you mentioned that, yeah, you'd hand her a 20 every once in a while. I'm like, oh my gosh, yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, and to think that's the least of the worst things that had happened in that situation. One of the other things that I thought was interesting too, and we've kind of touched on this a little bit in the podcast before, but just what kind of set the stage for this kind of structure, which really at the end of the day seems to come down to this patriarchal desire to maintain a certain level of power. And it really seems to have more to do with power and identity politics than anything else. And you kind of mentioned the fact that, you know, conservative politics in the 70s and 80s sort of aligned itself with conservative Christianity in order to sort of wage this war against certain issues like abortion and race and science and LGBTQ+ community and these sorts of things that sort of really kind of created this environment for this type of, like, I'll say twisted version of Christianity that has thrived specifically in North America to even exist and thrive.
Yeah, I will talk about that. What struck me, and it's related to building up the Christian right, within that sphere, a lot of where the power comes from is like this buddy system or this endorsement system, where people in higher leadership positions, people who can bring in large numbers of votes, to have that influence. There's a dynamic of influence swapping that then, like, kind of like lifts all ships. So if I endorse you politically, then you can get the laws passed that I want. Like, that's just how things work. But also that I will bring in my fellow, like, and the political leaders will go to your practice, will rub shoulders with these other ministers who are up and coming, that they'll be able to say that they know these particular political figures, like the Huckabee, Sarah Palin, these are folks that went to the authors' conferences. Like, it's all a mess. But I also see that in the way that just the ministries themselves learn to prop one another up. So even just looking within Vision Forum, which is a ministry that shed about a decade ago, but they had these catalogs where you could find books encouraging Christian patriarchy, stay-at-home daughter, her equivalent, all of that. And the endorsements, you know, one to the other and back and forth, which then creates this idea of authority, because the minister that I respect is another minister, and you create these new celebrities within evangelical Christianity. And that celebrity, I think, is that this is me theorizing, But I think that's an important part of how this authority and abuse structure works, because you end up with a lot of people in very influential positions who got there by who they know, which means the people they owe and the people they have to protect. And you also are in a position of authority that maybe you're not totally qualified for. Maybe you haven't gone to seminary, maybe you don't know you're Greek, but you're respected and you're influential, and people will come see you at a conference and buy your DVD. And I think that makes it would be natural for a person in that position to feel a little extra defensive, because even if they have the biggest CEO in the world somewhere, they have to recognize that their celebrity and their being in this upper echelon is built on sand. And so when that is threatened, that to me explains why people get so brutally defensive when someone questions or when someone comes forward with a story about abuse. Because if I can poke a hole in your authority over all of us, what else is there for you to stand on? Which I think it's in many ways is a lesson learned from how the Christian right was able to establish itself. It's that particular sort of network that when you overlay it and make it exclusive within a church, it can be very dangerous.
Yeah. Oh gosh.
Yes,
it does.
Sense?
Yes.
Yeah. I kind of got a role in there, but so. That's just these are things I think about.
Yeah. I mean, your book was incredibly thought provoking. I found myself kind of my brain moving off in multiple different directions, based on different things that you talk about in the book, and it just got me thinking about a lot of different things. And one of the things is that obviously this is not a new movement in terms of sort of trying to expose this abuse. This is definitely not something new, sadly. But as you said, there are things like the internet that have helped sort of shine a spotlight on it, and I think are forcing us as a society to acknowledge its existence in a way that maybe we couldn't before, and it forces us to deal with it. Whereas before, as you said, probably before the internet, there were probably countless stories like this that were more easily swept under the rug. But now, things like your book and these websites social media and these things, these platforms that people have where they can share these stories instantaneously and put it in front of a countless number of people, an infinite audience. What is your hope, coming out of this book and writing this book and putting these stories out there? What do you see coming out of this going forward?
I'm starting to get reader response, which is interesting. I recognize that I wrote a hard book, and I even encourage people in the intro to take their time. And people are. So I'm hearing from survivors who took a month and a half or so to read the book. And it's triggering, and it also makes them feel seen. So I think my first goal is just for people to know someone has seen all of this. I just want people to bear witness to it. My second hope, and it goes two directions. I am working with an American Baptist pastor in my town to do an event about the book and bring in the clergy. And when we have them there about this book, he said, "What do you want to do?" I said, "Let's train them." So we're bringing in Grace, and they're going to do an introductory training on how to keep your congregation safe. So I want to be involved in just encouraging clergy to understand, you have responsibility here, and you can deploy that solution and be part of the solution. And on the other side, I'm hoping to spotlight folks like in Ohio, Representative Jessica Miranda, who's pushing legislation to extend the statute of limitations for child sexual abuse. You'll see, as you saw throughout the book, very often the statute of limitations just was a roadblock that could not be passed in getting justice for people who it takes quite a while to confront what they dealt with as kids. So I think if the book can be a vehicle for people to know, we know you're there, and then also maybe change some churches and change some laws, that's what I'd like to do.
Yeah. And the other thing I think of too is from the perspective of someone who's a guy, clearly, and I think it's easy to, from the perspective of being a guy, is to think, well, these stories are about women, and surely I can't possibly understand what it's like to go through that experience. I'm not a woman. I never will be. And I don't know. I don't know what it's like. I can imagine what it's like. But I think guys have a massive role to play in this, in the sense that when we see these things happen, we've got to hold our other guys accountable. And you know, I think back to the story we talked about earlier, where there's this entire board, presumably of men, who's just sort of let it slide. Yeah. And they're in a position to do something and say, no, this isn't okay. This is not acceptable behavior by our fellow man here. And it shouldn't take, you know, having a daughter, for example, you know, to say, I would never want that to happen to my daughter. Like, the humanity within you should be enough to say, this isn't right. This is not loving. This is not what Jesus wanted. And we need to stand up, you know, and speak out and support our sisters and our mothers and, you know, and make sure that this sort of thing doesn't happen again. Cause this is abuse. It's abuse. And
some male survivors too.
Yes. Yeah.
Which, yes. Yeah. Yeah. And that's, I think so. I'm sorry.
No.
There are male survivors too. And especially in evangelicalism, it's been the women who are just put forward first. And I think there's a whole lot of other baggage stemming from the form of faith they were raised with that makes it sometimes even more difficult for the men to step up and say, this happened to me. So this is a cause that the people at the forefront of advocacy have been women. It's in service to everyone.
Yeah. Oh, gosh, there's so many different psychological aspects to that that we didn't even get into, you know, like the notion that so many of us were raised to think that to be a man means to never show your feelings or show supposed weakness and all these things. And that's had a lasting impact, generational impact, on the way that we handle situations like this, to our own mental health and admitting when we need help and allowing ourselves to express feelings and that sort of thing. There's a lot of work to be done. I think it's safe to say. Yeah. Well, I really appreciate you coming on the show. The book is fantastic. Again, I think, you know, anything that helps shine a light on situations like this that hopefully help move people to start giving a safe space to victims and providing resources like you talk about. It kills me to hear that anyone wasn't provided with the mental health resources that they're asking for. Is just devastating. We got to do better. And I appreciate this book. So again, it's Disobedient Women, How a Small Group of Faithful Women Exposed Abuse, Brought Down Powerful Pastors, and Ignited an Evangelical Reckoning. Sarah Stancorp, thank you very much for coming on the show.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Finished seminary, married, found a church he could go home. Made a living, giving down. until he told his leaders that he had some feelings for another man. And they said, John, you must go and take your broken heart and walk it to the door. We know you're but now your damaged goods and you gotta give some more. John, we love you, but we can't love you. You must go. Jane was born with skin darker than her peers. Spent a cycle telling them the reasons for her fears. No one seemed to know or care about the past. With every vote they cast, and they said, Jane, thanks for your time, but there's no room for you when there's power on the line. We know you're hurting, but we're not listening.
Why is life better with American Family Insurance? Because every policy comes with something very special. A trusted agent who's there to help protect your dreams by finding the right coverage at the right price. Save up to 23% when you bundle home and auto. American Family Insurance. Get a quote and find an agent at AmFam.com.
Products not available in every state. Visit AmFam.com to learn how discounts may apply to you. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.